Conversations like you're about to hear do not happen unless you support In Defense of Plants. And now more than ever, we need conversations like this to reach as many ears as possible. One of the best ways to help keep In Defense of Plants up and running is to become a patron over at patreon.com/indefenseofplants. In return for a tiny bit of support each month, you will get access to a completely separate podcast. It explores a lot of really fun gardening topics, everything from seed collection and storage to growing native plants, the struggles of trying to garden in different climates, and so much more. It's a heck of a lot of fun. We're learning so much and we're trying to share that with you. So come on and join the Patreon over at patreon.com/indefenseofplants and help keep this show up and running in the process. I hope to see you over there. But in the meantime, on with the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? What happens when you lose major seed dispersers? As you can imagine, plants tend to suffer, but plants are habitat. And what happens to those habitats? What happens to the entire ecosystem, to the people that rely on these forests? And inevitably, does that scale up to the way these ecosystems influence things like climate? These are the kinds of questions that Dr. Therese Lamperty has been thinking about throughout her research career. As you can imagine, this is a very challenging world to study, but it's a very important one because entire ecosystems rely on how plant communities regenerate. So why bother belaying the point any longer? Let's just jump right into it. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Therese Lamperty. I hope you enjoy. All right, Dr. Therese Lamperty, welcome to the podcast. I can't wait to pick your brain today. So start off with an introduction. Tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm Therese. Even though I've had my PhD for 5 years, it's still kind of surprising to hear people say, like, Dr. Therese Lamperty. It's like, oh, am I introducing a stranger? But yeah, I'm a community ecologist, which means I like to study how species interactions shape ecological communities and the ecosystems that they exist in and how those ecosystems function. A lot of that work has centered around seed dispersal in tropical forests. So tropical forests rely on animals that eat fruit and swallow seeds and then move and either regurgitate or poop out the seed. They rely on those seed dispersers to plant the forest and facilitate regeneration. I think the stat that a lot of people like to throw out is that over 90% of tropical species rely on animals for seed dispersal. Oh, wow. And so it's a really important process that keeps tropical forests functioning. And that is definitely what I started my PhD focusing on. But, you know, things get kind of, you like look too far down one rabbit hole and find a distracting question and pursue that instead. So,
oh, of course,
like I've been all over the place.
I mean, that's the beauty of ecology is you pick up one thread and, you know, as the old adage goes, it's attached to countless others. I mean, ones we'll still won't get our heads wrapped around for centuries, but, you know, was it always community ecology for you? Is this something that you've always had a passion for? Or did you kind of stumble into it throughout, you know, internships, career, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I guess I definitely stumbled into it through internships.
Nice.
Yeah. So growing up, my dad, I think, did a really good job of getting me interested in being outside. He grew up in Venezuela and he had a lot of cool stories. And I think that helped encourage me to go out and be curious about the natural world. And I think I was probably a high schooler when I realized that ecology and conservation biology was an option. So I tried to get into college to do that. And I grew up in a low income area where I didn't really have a lot of people who could serve as an example of like, this is how you get from where you're at to being an ecologist. So I was very much just stumbling around being like, I like wildlife. I like being outside. And that eventually got me into college and a professor who at the time was new to Emory University. His name is Dr. Barry Brosi. He's at the University of Washington now. But he started at Emory when I started as a new student and he needed a research tech. So he invited me to come out with him to Colorado. to start studying plant pollinator interactions. Hmm. And that was when things started to click for me, like, oh, I'm very interested in the role that these tiny little insects play in making this beautiful wildflower meadow and keeping it healthy. But I also, I knew that I probably wanted to go to the tropics just from all the stories that my dad told me. So I, when I realized that seed dispersal was a big thing in tropical forests, I was like, oh yeah, that's going to be what I try to pursue.
Nice.
Yeah.
And here you are, right? And that's what's really cool about it is whether you stumble or you kind of have an idea or a pathway in your head, you know, this is the beauty of ecology. You get into the biological sciences, especially the ecological sciences, and, you know, whether it's plants, whether it's animals, there's something new, there's something interesting, and it could take you all around the world because the principles of ecology apply in many different scenarios. It's just how do they apply is the big question. And it's really interesting to think about it from, you know, the plant-animal interaction there, because it sounds like at all points, it's really how do you set up a habitat, which is the plants.
Yeah. Yeah. The plants are what give structure to the ecosystem. That's kind of how I think about it. And yeah, make a home for the animals that exist there. But I think it's really cool to look at how those two pieces evolve together and learn to actually need each other, not learn, but evolve to need each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's great that, you know, even from your early days of being a researcher, being a scientist, it has been that interaction, because I think a lot of us get into this field and not pigeonholed, but you kind of are like, okay, what do you want to do? Do you want to do plants or do you want to do animals? And when you start to talk to people, you go, oh, you're doing ecosystem stuff. You're just taking a slice of it. And a lot, I think a lot of times it's not even pitched like that. It's, no, I study birds. It's like, well, birds are eating something. They're nesting somewhere. They're spreading seeds, that sort of thing.
Yeah. They need certain things in their ecosystem. That whole, like, do you study plants or animals? Like, what do you study? That definitely never goes away. People still ask me that. And I feel like I disappoint them when I say I study both. I study the interaction and how they need each other.
I think a lot of people take it for granted, though, and don't think about, you know, yeah, these plants have to come from somewhere. And sure, wind plays a role, water plays a role. There's a lot of abiotic forces that get involved in that. But all of us can get our heads wrapped around some sort of animal-based seed dispersal system. I mean, heck, we get involved in it. It's just most of what we're doing ends up, you know, in the sewer system or something like that. But at its core value, you know, plants absolutely rely on these organisms to move them around. So how did you, given the vastness of this topic, how did you start to bite off a sizable chunk that made sense for you?
That's a good question. I remember, so when I started my PhD, it was pretty awesome that my advisor, she is Dr. Amy Dunham at Rice University. She sat me down and was like, you should be really thoughtful about what you want to study. And then she told me to go and read a bunch of recent-ish papers. So I did a lot of trying to see what grabbed my interest and where there was a gap and knowledge is what we call it. When you're trying to find your spot in the research world, you have to locate what has no one done yet, which is getting harder and harder. So a lot of reading eventually led me to this question of what's happening as humans are, you know, the global population is growing, and especially populations that live near tropical forests, they rely on those tropical forests for their livelihood, for a lot of resources, and the pressure on the animal communities and on the plant communities in those forests is just increasing. And now there's a lot of like oil roads being built and logging that's happening that is getting humans farther and farther into the forest. And basically increasing the spread of hunting. It's increasing the area of tropical forests that is subject to unsustainable hunting. And now we've got global markets. So there's more than just subsistence hunting. There's a motivation to take more than is sustainable so that you can sell it. And That's creating this pattern of defaunation, where if you think about hunting, it's a non-random species loss, like the larger bodied animals that are worth the target. They're worth the bullet, and they also are targeted because they taste good. So we lose those from the system, and we don't really know, or at least 10 years ago when I was starting to decide what I would study, we didn't have the best idea of what role they play in an ecosystem. And, you know, do the plants that they eat really need these animals? And what happens when you lose them? So reading about that made me realize, okay, I want to know what happens when there's too much hunting and we lose all these large bodied animals. And so from there, I kind of started to ask questions about what happens when you lose long distance seed dispersal, what happens with the population genetics of the plants, and followed it from there. Wasn't my only focus, but it was definitely, that was the main one.
Sure. It's heavy. I mean, you're at really the interface of loss there. And that's something we, most of us get into biology to hopefully avoid or prevent, but to understand its effects is almost as important, if not more important, because we need to know what all of these roles are playing to, you know, then bring it to a wider audience to say, no, we absolutely need this. Because I think we're still, at least in sort of the common way of talking about biodiversity loss, stuck in this sort of single species way of thinking about it. And that's okay. Yeah. It is sad to lose a rhino. It is sad to lose an elephant as a species. It's a tragedy. And especially if we're at fault for it. But when you start to really drill in, you go, okay, this is a ripple effect. What else is going to happen here? And I think a lot of times people will say, well, why is it sad if we lose a flower or if we lose a, I don't know, you name it.
Like a monkey.
A monkey, right? Yeah. It's sad, but like, yeah, what's the effect? Like, this is what you're doing. You're quantifying the effects of what that loss does to the ecosystem.
Definitely the idea. Of course, these, as I've learned, these tropical forests are so diverse. There's so much going on. It's really hard to actually draw conclusions about the consequences of losing one species when you're looking at it in its natural setting with all these other things going on. But we have been able to see some patterns that are real, for example, and troubling. For example, the trees in tropical forests that have larger fruits that rely on larger bodied animals for seed dispersal, they tend to be more carbon dense. So they're playing a bigger role in carbon storage in these tropical forests. And there's been some models that indicate, okay, when we're losing seed dispersing animals, we're giving a competitive edge to trees that are wind dispersed and that are less carbon dense. So over time, the idea is that the forest tree community could start to shift to something that stores less carbon, which would be bad for everybody.
Right. And that kind of gets to a question I originally had when I started diving into your research is, yeah, you do so much of your work in hyperdiverse systems. How do you begin to narrow it down to make it feasible to actually do the research, let alone understand the species that you're targeting? Because I would imagine even knowing who the dispersers are is a challenge in and of itself, let alone the effects of losing those.
Yeah. You have to start small. Well, okay. I think you should start small. I tend to start big. I'm like, I'm going to write this big, really ambitious project proposal. I'm going to know everything that's happening in the forest. But it doesn't really work out like that. I end up kind of narrowing down and figuring out what can I do at a smaller scale and try to make some really educated guesses. You know, what does my data support? But we can never, I feel in my research, at least, I can never say for certain that what is happening is because of hunting. But looking at the population genetic structure, which is basically like how clumped are related individuals of trees across areas with different hunting pressures. That's a study I did, and it looked like when you have more hunting, you have a greater clumping of related plants that rely on animals for dispersal. So you take out the animals that are dispersing the plants. And then you look at the landscape and you've got a lot of neighboring trees that are highly related because their seeds aren't getting pushed very far around in the landscape. So the argument is, okay, that's probably because we messed up the seed dispersal pattern, and future consequences could be increased inbreeding because you've got all these related individuals trading pollen. But did I collect data that said that inbreeding is happening because of hunting? I'm not so sure.
Right.
It's definitely just like a, here's a piece to the puzzle, something that we're thinking about. And probably that's what's happening. But I do always feel like, no, I can't say anything for certain.
Can we ever in ecology? I mean, it's...
I don't know.
It's one of those fields.
It is. Yeah, it's a mess. It's a messy field. Maybe one day, that's the dream, to have like a perfect correlation in one of your graphs and be like, yes, this is what is driving this pattern.
Yeah. I mean, that's what,
what's going on.
Physics envy is real. It really is.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Give me some laws, please.
Right. But
yeah,
I mean, this is the difficulties, and it's so good to hear someone with boots on the ground explaining that, is it's so hard to communicate this stuff in a way that makes accurate sense, let alone start to drill into the nuances of what it means to actually do the research, to actually try to make conclusions out of what can be exceptionally noisy data sets. But I think what really caught me about your work and what's most fascinating about it is sort of its relationship to other patterns and other systems. When you look across scales, like ecology is a very scalable science, in the sense that the clustering that you just described there, where you're getting areas where a lot of trees are very closely related in small patches, is very similar to stuff you see in insect dispersal. When you lose ants, for instance, in the southeast of North America, you'll see spring ephemerals that tend to be more clustered. And you go, oh, that's a lack of dispersal. So when you see those patterns start to repeat themselves, at least you know you got some head scratchers to work from.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. And I think my PhD advisor was really wonderful, and she always drilled home, like, whatever question you're trying to answer, you want to make it relevant across systems, and that will help you actually, you know, uncover something. I don't want to say meaningful, because it sounds, everyone's work is meaningful, but it's awesome if you can look at something and be like, oh, we see this pattern when we mess up this part of the equation in the tropics. Also, we see that in temperate systems in North America or something when we also mess up a similar part of the equation, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's that replicability of, okay, are we getting to something at the core of nature, you know, biology, interactions, whatever you want to call it. You know, there's only so many ways ecosystems work, right? And you know, whether that's temperate, tropical, desert, tundra, you know, there are constraints. And so the interesting things arise when you go, oh, wow, similar patterns are happening here and here and here at this scale, at this scale, at this scale.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
So when you think of the tropics, though, you know, I'm getting my head wrapped around, like, not all tropical forests are the same, right? So where exactly have you been working on these sorts of problems, and how do you choose species? Like, what species are you choosing, and how do you narrow those down? Hmm.
That's another good question. So I started working in Central Africa in Gabon, which is on the west coast of Africa, in the Congo Basin. And I guess I was 24 and knew I really loved Africa. I'd gone there to study abroad when I was an undergrad. And somehow I felt really drawn back. So I would say that's not the most scientific motivation, but that's what my motivation was. And I also felt like, hey, we've got a lot of research in the neotropics compared to the afrotropics. Hmm. That was a big motivator. Like maybe there's something useful I can contribute there. My PhD advisor was like, okay, if you want to try that, then let's try to make it work. So applied for a bunch of funding, got myself down there. And then you start to realize, like, okay, if I want to, what did I want to do when I first went there? I think I wanted to do a project looking at, like, what happens when there's a lot of hunting, what happens to the population genetics of the plants that the animals that are being hunted are responsible for dispersing. But then you get on the ground and you're like, what plant can I identify for sure that exists in high enough quantities across the landscape in areas where I have data to back up that the animal community is different, the seed disperser community is different because of hunting. Like, where can I set up this gradient? And when you get on the ground, you quickly realize that for your project idea to work, the context has to meet a handful of criteria, and that narrows it down real quick. Mm-hmm. And then if you're trying to do genetic work, it's like, what do we have molecular markers for? Mm-hmm. That narrows it down even farther. So that's how I landed on the species when I went to Africa for the first time and to Gabon. I was going to work on Gambea, which is elephant dispersed. And it's this delicious fruit that elephants love, but also other large terrestrial animals. And I went down there and it just didn't fruit at all. And it was a La Nina year. Yeah, it didn't work out. And so I ended up studying something else. And I think that that's kind of how ecology works a lot of the time. I was there and I was like, well, my species isn't fruiting. I can't study seed dispersal. What else does hunting change? What else does defaunation and losing large animals change? And I noticed walking around between these like heavily hunted and then these really remote unhunted areas that the understory vegetation seemed to have a different density. And so I totally changed directions and was like, what's happening in the understory? And did a project on that. Like when there's elephants and forest buffalo and gorilla, and there's a lot of amazing megafauna that we like to call megafauna that exists in the Afrotropics that really thin out the understory, because there's a lot of foraging, but also just elephant trails are huge, and that really thins out the vegetation. So I wanted to know, can we quantify that? And then what changes in the leaf litter and what changes with the insects that live in the leaf litter, and trace it down to things that matter, like decomposition rates and stuff like that. But the root of it, of that whole project, was really me just being like, my first project didn't work out. what can I do? I know these animals are important. There's other questions I could ask.
I love that, though, because A, it gets at how messy just doing science can be, you know, adapt or pivot.
Very
or,
unpredictable.
Yeah, or you just can't survive. But at the same time, field observations, getting out into the woods, into the field, into whatever ecosystem you want to do, and just start observing, right? And that is so vital. And I think it's missing from a lot of science these days is, oh, we just pick up where the literature is and go for the easy, you know, low hanging of multiple replicates and a good statistical model, right? But being out in the field really starts to unveil a lot of patterns that otherwise, you know, the literature is not necessarily going to cover, because, you know, who's making natural history observations and publishing them that much these days?
Yeah, not that much. I get kind of jealous when you read the papers from the 70s and it really is like a natural history note, and you're like, you probably enjoyed writing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you saying that. I think the big data movement is important, and it's really cool that we can, from wherever our office is at, we can pull a lot of people's data and ask big questions. But what is lost is probably time on the ground and observations on the ground. Yeah. So that's important too. Yeah.
So as a scientist in training, trying to make it work, I'd imagine even just getting out into the woods, finding spots is great. Okay, first challenge. But then the next challenge of, what am I even looking at? Because, you know, I don't know African plants, right? Like, unless it's made it to the horticulture trade, I'm not going to be familiar with what's on the ground. So what were those challenges like just doing the field biology portion of this?
Yeah, those challenges. So you get there and you really quickly realize that you don't really know much about these forests. And the people that know a lot about these forests are the people who live there and who rely on the forest for their livelihood. They're the hunters. So like, I almost exclusively work with poachers who know the forest extremely well. And they, I think to this day, most people I know with PhDs in tropical ecology would also say, like, no, it's my guides knew everything. They're extremely good with identifying plants, and then they can tell you what their grandmas use these plants for medicinally. And there's just an amazing amount of knowledge and respect for the forest in the places I've worked. And I think that hopefully that's more recognized now, but I do think it gets overlooked a lot, that the people who hunt and rely on the forest for resources they're not like the enemy to conservation efforts. They're actually the people who know more about it than you ever will. But yeah, the people who taught me how to identify plants have been the indigenous people who grew up there. And it's kind of a weird thing to start to become aware of that and be like, oh, I'm the one with these letters at the end of my name, but these guys have all the knowledge. So I think it's very important to make sure you're collaborating in a meaningful way with local people when you travel into the forest for that reason.
Sure, sure. And I think, you know, I think the real recognition is you both are coming at it from different perspectives, right? And that's where the collaboration happens, and not, you know, it's not taking and utilizing and exploiting. It's no, you have it for your daily needs, your life, your entire experience in this world has been this forest, and I'm coming at it from a very vastly different perspective. But being able to find where those things overlap and learn from each other, I think, is a very powerful thing to exchanging cultures and experiences like that. And obviously you've come away with a vastly different experience and perspective on it. Even the poaching, I mean, the fact that you had to work with people like this, I think there's an image of poachers as very, you know, Western, going out and just shooting for the, but it's such a nuanced topic. And I'm sure when you see it face to face and have to come to terms with the reality of it, it's a tough pill to swallow, but it's a very nuanced subject in countries like that.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. If you had to choose between feeding your family or saving an elephant, like, you'd probably feed your family. I don't know. It's easy to understand where they're coming from once you get down there. Yeah.
Yeah. But what was field work like, though? You know, you're out with guides, you're out trying to understand this place, and at the same time, you have to keep the statistical model in your head. You have to know you're collecting data that are usable, right? It's like all of these things in the field, we romanticize stories of field work. But then, you know, you think back to what you were doing when you're swatting flies, getting bit and scratched and sweating, that tug of war of, I need to survive this. I need to keep my mental strength, but also I have to do something here that's viable scientifically.
Yeah. Oh, you summarized it pretty well. I mean, like, that's the struggle. It is hard. you're there being like, oh, I know I have to go back to my office at some point and have numbers that I can run statistical tests on and that I can write about and pull a story out of this. But also, I'm exhausted and we ran out of food 3 days ago. Like, what do I do? Yeah, it's hard. I think a lot of my peers and myself would say that it's the best of the best and the worst of the worst. Like, when things go wrong and you're in a really remote area in the tropics, it can be really horrible. But when it's going right, it's also this amazing privilege to canoe down a river and see an elephant walk across the river in front of you, or look at these. I really love the trees. They're just so big in the tropics. Yeah, very impressive to be under a closed canopy in a tropical forest. But yeah, I'd say the field work is really hard, and the field work is really, it's not just ecology. Once you get down to a tropical area, you realize, like, at least the places that I've worked, these are places that people have taken advantage of. The footprint of colonialism is everywhere, and you can kind of connect the dots to figure out, like, how we got to the situation we're in. And especially if you're studying the effects of hunting, like the ecological cascades of hunting on plant communities, you end up thinking a lot about, like, why is hunting an unsustainable practice right here? It's because there's probably foreign company that's mining oil, and they built a road, and they're taking advantage of the indigenous population. Yeah. It's, it becomes more than just science.
Yeah. Heavy yeah. pills to swallow. And, you know, when you think of yeah. the plants that support both the animals you're studying, but also the communities you're working with, you're living in, you know, what are these species that really kind of form the backbone of not only your work, but everything from the animal communities to the people that have to live in these areas? Like, what, which ones helped you tell your story or had the most meaningful impact on the scientific story you're trying to tell?
I think palms have been pretty central, like the palm family. Really anything that primates eat, people also eat and end up being very important for local people to live off of. I guess I don't know so much how to answer that question because there's a huge diversity of plants and most of them do need animals, but also get eaten by people. There's no one species I could pick out.
That's fair. I mean, that's interesting in and of itself, because when you see the finished product, you think of, oh, okay, well, you went in, we've already described how you didn't go in with anything, or if you had predeterminations, it was vastly different once you hit the ground running. But to know it's as nuanced and as complicated as I can't even really point to a single species, that just goes to show you how difficult this kind of research truly is. And being able to pull apart those different pieces and make something coherent and really start to see patterns is in and of itself quite a challenge, I'd assume.
Yeah, it can. Yes, it is a challenge. And it is often it is that thing where you get on the ground and you're like, what do I have enough of that I can find, that I can ID? Yeah, that fits these different criteria. And often I think that is kind of why I said palms. I think that palm trees are really abundant, especially once I switched to working in the neotropics. And palm trees are everywhere and they're an important part of tropical ecosystems, but also important yeah. for people. And so generally you can find enough of them to try to get data that tells a story, that you can make sense out of. But I think being able to use the network perspective is also really helpful in drawing conclusions about patterns, where you can look at a couple different species and see which of trees and see which species of primates or birds or whatever seed disperser is visiting them, and then draw conclusions about how important are those animals for the whole forest. It allows you to zoom out a little bit and get this community mm-hmm. perspective. If you know that spider monkeys are really highly hunted, but you also see in your network analysis, like I've seen spider monkeys eat from these 10 different species. I know that spider monkeys are generalists. And so if you knock that out of the network, we're going to have this co-extinction cascade, which is a bit dramatic. It doesn't actually happen in real life, but it is like these trees, like a lot of trees are going to lose an important disperser. So techniques like that, like using the network analysis perspective, can help to make sense out of this like big messy picture.
Yeah. I'm glad you went there. That's a perfect segue, because obviously doing your PhD is sort of this monumental thing, and the person you go in being isn't necessarily the person you come out being. Hopefully you've grown in the process, right? But
yeah.
the science evolves with you, right? And it's obvious you've expanded your reach. And so this idea of sort of generalist and specialist is really interesting in this context, because I would imagine you're running into far more generalists than you are specialists. But, you know, you think about it from how people are talking about it in the insect world, there are a lot of specialists. So when you start to see this difference in sort of the big picture patterning of when you start to think of loss, like, is it harder a lot of times, or are there patterns that show losing at the specialist or the generalist? Like, how does that start to shake out? Or is it kind of, it depends on the system, it depends on where you are, it's really hard to make big conclusions about that generalist-specialist relationship with plants?
It is, yes, to the last couple statements you made.
Perfect, like that, yes. I just threw them all out there and I figured one would work.
that tends to be the rule. I would say, again, not so, let's think about neotropical forests, because okay. I feel like I can't comfortably say this like in the in like Southeast Asia, there's less reliance on animal mediated seed dispersal. So if we were to think about the Amazon, most of the interactions are generalist interactions. As a plant, you have probably evolved to be attractive to a big variety of dispersers. So little birds, big birds, monkeys, they can all come and eat your fruit. Your seed is small enough that it can be swallowed whole. So when that animal eats the fruit, it's not destroying your seed or just spitting it right where you are, you being the plant, it's going to take it somewhere else. So that is usually, I think, that's the evolutionary tactic that most fruiting plants took in the Amazon. And like figs, if you think about figs, they're a good example. Like everything loves to eat figs, and that's great. And then there's
me too.
and there's not as many specialists, and the ones that do exist, it seems to be like a pretty severe trade-off. Like you have really big fruit, it's pretty energetic to make, and you've got a giant seed, also pretty energetic to make. And maybe having a big seed, if that seed gets to a favorable little microhabitat where it might be able to grow and it has a little bit of light, if you have a big seed, maybe it's got a lot of resources. So the chances of survival once dispersed are higher than if you have a bunch of little seeds. But that means that there's only a couple animals that are big enough to actually eat your seed, swallow it, take it somewhere else. So those are the specialists typically in this scenario. And there aren't that many of those relationships where it's like a plant with one huge seed and one or two animals that are capable of coming and eating and swallowing that seed. I guess from the animal perspective, they would go to that specific species presumably because there's less competition, but I'm not really sure how much competition affects frugivory in the tropics, because in a good year, there's a lot of fruit. There might not be that much competition.
It makes sense, though. It's fun to think about differences in plant life stages. Like a plant could have a very specialized pollinator relationship, but the most generalistic seed dispersal mechanism, because that's the other side of this story. So it's fun to think of how different stages of even these ecological relationships throughout, an organism's entire life cycle can be more generalist or more specialist over that spectrum. And it would make sense, like, hey, get your seeds away from competition with your closest kin. That makes sense. That would be kind of like open, more of an open door.
Yeah. And I think this is an area that we're still learning about, but it is like, if you're a parent plant for most of the species in the tropics, if your seed lands right next to you, as the parent plant, you've already attracted a lot of specialized plant enemies and soil pathogens that specialize on you as a species and maybe even you as a genotype. So survival is a lot lower for seeds that land right under their parent. Which I probably should have said in the beginning, but that's the whole reason why seed dispersal is so important, is that in most tropical tree species, survival probability is very low close to the parent, and it increases a lot when you get farther away.
Yeah. I mean, many of us listening can empathize with wanting to get away from your family for a little bit.
Yeah. You're just going to flourish. You're going to do better.
Right.
Get more sunlight.
But thinking of, again, how your science has evolved, being a postdoc, you're moving around a lot, you're trying to get your feet on the ground, create a research program around yourself. So like, how are the questions evolving that you're asking and your approach to trying to solve some of them?
Yeah, so at some point in my PhD, I realized the Afrotropics I loved, but I'd need more resources before I could do meaningful research there. So I switched to the Amazon. And I've gotten really excited about research in the Amazon. And that has led me to get kind of invested in the Yasuni National Park area, where where Ecuador's largest oil reserves are. And it's a really interesting interface between like a major biodiversity hotspot in the Amazon and also a major hunting area, because when you have oil extraction, you've got roads that increases access to forest interior, and also access to firearms by indigenous groups. So I would say that my research interests have evolved in that direction, because the more time I spent in South America, the more I started to learn about specific situations there and where there was maybe room for me to make a meaningful contribution. So that landed me in Ecuador doing my NSF postdoctoral research. But I don't know, I guess to answer your question, it's sort of, I'm working hard to see what kind of contribution I can make there, but still trying to think about what questions I can ask that are relevant to systems beyond the tropics in Ecuador. And I'm not really sure what that's going to look like in the next step. I mean, I think climate change is going to add an interesting aspect that I might start to want to ask questions about. Like, we're losing seed dispersers and we're messing up when plants fruit. So how are these plants ever going to get dispersed?
Right. And I'd imagine, but, too, like the changes we're doing, whether that's just habitat degradation, modification, like you don't have to outright hunt something to extinction in an area, or extirpation, I should say, for it to affect seed dispersal or the dynamics of species interactions. Yeah. Like, yeah, just species moving up a mountainside because it's too warm at lower elevations could really, you know, again, not to add to the complications that make your data sets noisy, but there's a lot of different ways to approach these sorts of basic ecological interactions.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways that humans are affecting these basic, very important ecological interactions. So I'm interested in all the ways we're changing them. And then what does that mean for future plant communities and for carbon storage? I would say that that's a big background motivator for me, is what do these changes mean for the global climate? But I mean, I'm also a scientist that exists in this world. So part of what shapes what direction I go is what are people going to fund? Where can I actually find a little space and also make sure I'm actually doing good, which I think most of us who are ecologists, we're really motivated by trying to like increase conservation efforts and, you know, do capacity building and where we're working. So, there's more than just science that will shape which way I go, I guess. Yeah.
Well, the good news is I've been doing, you know, science and talking to scientists for over a decade, and I've never met one that says, I want to do bad things with what I'm doing. So
yeah, those people don't hang out outside. I don't think they go outside.
Right. Yeah. I'd imagine it's a challenge on all aspects, because it is, like you said, this social interaction, it's funding, it's being a scientist just in what the world we're in today, and especially as, you know, a scientist in the United States dealing with funding issues, you know, through NSF and that sort of stuff. But then you add the complications of everything from geopolitics to resource extraction, and impoverished areas oftentimes are the ones that are getting hit the worst, and it's a tug of war, I'm sure. And it's definitely one of those things that you know, you've got to have some heavy days, but I would imagine, like you said, when it goes well, the rewards have got to feel just spectacular. To know it's a massive contribution, because every aspect of seed dispersal, you know, it seems so immediate in the moment that a bird is pooping a seed somewhere, right? To be crude about it. But
yeah, that's
how forests are made, and forests sequester carbon. They support communities. They filter our air. They clean our water. Like, it's at the fundamental basis of like what we need. And that's not to just say it's just forests either. Like, imagine this in every other ecosystem where animals are dispersing seeds.
Yeah. Yeah. Well put. And pollinators too.
Yes.
It's both. Yeah.
And so, you know, a big part of, you know, trying to understand this too is the molecular side of things. How, you know, I mean, that's got to have changed even in the time since you've been doing it, and trying to get your head from the field ecologist in the statistical mind space to, oh, okay, now I got to do molecular work too. I would imagine that adds its own fascinating but set of complications.
Yeah, there might not be enough time, at least if your brain works at the speed mine does, there might not be enough time to spend a lot of time in the field and, you know, making observations and coming up with great questions. or at least passable questions to then go back and learn the most cutting edge molecular approaches to produce research that is going to give us new information. Because yeah, the molecular tools are advancing very rapidly, and that's wonderful. It's great. But I do kind of feel, for me, that that means I can do one or the other. And I think that's just because I didn't have a lot of formal training as a molecular ecologist. I think some people can do both. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's difficult to keep up with the latest methods, but also, like, I spent most of last year in Ecuador in the forest. So yeah, maybe you can't do both, which is why collaboration is so important.
Perfect.
Yeah, I think that's probably, we're just going to accomplish a whole lot more together. As like kumbaya as that sounds.
It's true.
What we need.
It takes a village. It really does. And we can't be, you know, in a world of specialization, that's the good and bad of it, is you can get really good at something, yeah, but it can also mean you're doing it at the cost of other things. But that's where everyone listening, whether you're a math person, an accounting person, or a molecular person, like, you can get involved in this in one way or another. It's amazing what different skill sets can bring to the table. I mean, even just understanding the psychology of people, to understand, you know, why is this happening out there? Like, you can get involved in this sort of work. And that's what's great about your field is, yeah, you could, you, hey, we need collaborators. What do you do?
We need everybody's perspective on this, like, especially in the tropics. I think it's a really, it's an intersection of a lot of different issues, social, cultural, economic, ecological. So we need people who are experts in those different areas, and it's hard to find one person who is. So yeah, collaboration matters a lot.
Big time.
It's definitely been, yeah, my favorite thing is probably to get students with different interests down there to hear their thoughts and be like, okay, I've done my part. Now they're gonna go and take this and run with it.
Go for it. Elaborate. Yeah. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And so with that in mind, if people want to keep a finger on the pulse of your work, see where your research takes you, or maybe even reach out with something to, you know, pitch in or have an insight, where do you recommend they go looking for more?
Oh, shoot. That's a very nice of you to ask. I'm at a weird crossroads in my career. So I just took a position with a nonprofit. So I'm going to be working in wetlands in North America for a little bit. I have no idea where my research is headed next. You know, shoot me an email. Probably I'm not the only ecologist who does a crummy job with keeping up on social media, et cetera. My website's probably out of date, but I'm always happy to talk to people, and ask me in a year and I'll know what I'm going to be doing. Right now, I'm just here.
Yeah. It's all we can be, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, the science scene has changed a little bit in the last year. So it's
ever so slightly. It's terrifying, so, but we're making it happen regardless. Dr. Lamperty, this has been a fascinating insight into a very complicated but very important realm. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
Of course. Well, in the meantime, hang in there and keep us posted. We'd like to know what you're doing, getting your boots wet these days.
Thanks. Sounds good.
Cheers. All right. Very heavy and very important stuff. I thank Dr. Lamperty for taking time out of her busy schedule to talk with us. And as always, go check the show notes over at indefensiveplants.com, because that's where I put links so that you can learn more about this subject. And it's a heavy subject. There is a lot of research to be done. And I'm really thankful for people like Dr. Lamperty and all of her collaborators for taking the time to try to understand these dynamics. But of course, conversations like you heard do not happen unless you support the show. There's so many great ways to do that. For instance, you can become a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants and get access to an entirely separate podcast about gardening. You can also pick up a copy of my book, some of our customizable merch, and stickers. All of those are great ways to help keep this show up and running. Speaking of patrons, I have a shout out to the latest producers on this podcast. A big, big thank you goes out to Heidi and Nadia. Both of them signed up at the producer credit level, so they are maximizing their support of Indefensible Plants and helping episodes like this come to you each and every week. At the very least, make sure you hit that subscribe button and keep checking back in, because I always have great conversations waiting for you just over the horizon. But that is it for this week. I thank you all for listening. In the meantime, hang in there, stay healthy, and get outside if you can. This is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.